Now we are in the middle of the three chapters for this Unit 3. And there is an overall process that is the major concern of this chapter. It's not listed here, but part of it is. The overall theme of this chapter is the complete oxidation of glucose. What?
Is this chapter 4, you said?
I don't know what number it is. It's number 2 in the unit.
Yeah.
It's the middle of the... What number it is in the textbook doesn't matter because we don't even use the textbook. Anyway, the complete oxidation of glucose is what this whole chapter is about. And glucose is a fuel. It's not the only fuel that cells use, but we're studying its use because glucose is the master fuel in all cells, not just our cells. So glucose is the fuel used most often, more than any other type of fuel. Also, if other types of fuels that we'll see later are used, they share a lot of the same pathways that this overall process we're studying uses. But that's why it's from a glucose perspective. It's the master fuel. The complete oxidation of glucose is not a single-step process. It's many steps, many pathways, actually, each of which is many steps. But the complete oxidation of glucose refers to using that fuel to maximal efficiency, by which I mean using the fuel in such a way that you break it down completely so that all you have left can be thought of as completely spent fuel, which is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a carbon-containing compound, but remember I said that not every carbon-containing compound is considered to be organic. Carbon dioxide is not organic. So not only does the complete oxidation of glucose release energy that's stored temporarily as chemical energy in that fuel, which is why we're bothering to go through with this process, to get usable energy out of it. But also the complete oxidation of glucose starts with an organic fuel and ends with an inorganic end product, carbon dioxide. Now this is important because of what is really being represented by this slide. The green background, the green rectangle, is an ecosystem. Just about any ecosystem on Earth, doesn't matter which one you choose. But we see something I've told you before in previous chapters. For any given ecosystem, energy enters and leaves. It enters as sunlight, gets transferred and transformed within the ecosystem, and then exits as heat. Okay, now, that's illustrated by the yellow and red arrows. But what we're concerned with in this chapter is what happens within the ecosystem to that energy. And there is a reciprocal relationship between the theme of this chapter, which is the complete oxidation of glucose, and another complex set of reactions called photosynthesis, which is what we're going to study in next chapter. But what do I mean by a reciprocal relationship? Well, that means that one of these two major processes undoes the other. Photosynthesis undoes the complete oxidation of glucose. The complete oxidation of glucose undoes photosynthesis. Not by just working in complete reverse of each other, but they have the effect of working in the reverse. Okay, and that can be shown by starting and ending substances for both of these major processes. So, first of all, what's listed here as cellular respiration really should be listed as the complete oxidation of glucose. Cellular respiration is just part of that process. So I might as well tell you right now, just to make that more clear, that the overall process, the complete oxidation of glucose, consists of two major subdivisions: glycolysis first, and then cellular respiration. So cellular respiration here is just part of the overall process, is what I'm talking about. I just wish they had put complete oxidation of glucose here instead of cellular respiration. But anyway, let's look at the inputs and outputs for the two. Photosynthesis is performed only by producers. That's an ecological term, right? Ecologically speaking, there are two kinds of organisms, producers and consumers. Producers are able to make their own food. Consumers can't. Any given organism, in order to remain alive, requires organic compounds, because that's what all four macromolecules are, right? They are not just macromolecules, they're organic macromolecules. So all living things have to have organic compounds. Well, when I say that producers make their own food, there's a different way that you can say this that's more specific. Producers perform a very important feat. They are able to transform, or they're able to produce organic compounds out of inorganic carbon sources. No consumer can do this. Right? We consumers, have to get our carbon, which is required for our organic compounds that we're going to make, we have to have that carbon already in organic form. Right? We eat, for instance, that all of that food is from whatever organism you eat, is organic material. Now, we don't keep it in those molecules, right? The molecules get digested, the food gets digested. The individual organic compounds, small enough to enter our body, get absorbed. And then we make our own versions of organic compounds based on our genes. So we disassemble organic compounds and then reassemble them in our cells. But the point here is that we can't use building blocks that are inorganic. Our building blocks have to already be organic, and we just rearrange them into other organic compounds. That's not true for a producer. A producer can make organic compounds out of inorganic sources of carbon. Carbon dioxide, for instance, and most prevalent. That's why carbon dioxide is shown as an input into photosynthesis. Photosynthetic organisms are producers. And photosynthesis is able to take carbon dioxide and water, two things you have to give a plant, for instance, as a representative photosynthesizer. And by the many steps of involved in photosynthesis that we'll eventually study, it will produce sugars, which are organic compounds, and including glucose, the master fuel. And as a byproduct, it will produce oxygen. All right? So that is the important trick that only producers can do. They take inorganic carbon and use it to form organic compounds. That in particular is called carbon fixation. So that is the big deal about photosynthesis. It is a way to achieve carbon fixation. which is incorporating inorganic carbon sources into organic compounds. All right, but anyway, you start with CO2 and water, you end up with glucose and oxygen for photosynthesis. The reciprocal nature of these two processes is that the product of photosynthesis, glucose and oxygen, is the input or the reactants for the complete oxidation of glucose. So what photosynthesis spits out, complete oxidation of glucose takes in. Glucose and oxygen are the requirements. That gets transformed into carbon dioxide and water, which can then go back for another round in photosynthesis, just over and over. All right? Now, a little bit ago I said that the complete oxidation of glucose means getting as much energy as possible out of that glucose. Glucose contains energy. Cellular respiration, which is the first overall part of this whole process we're studying in this chapter, complete oxidation of glucose, that first part, glycolysis, gets some of the energy out of the glucose, but not all of it. And how is that energy trapped? In what form? When I keep saying that we get energy out of the glucose, what do we do with the energy? Well, that's how it's gotten out of the fuel. But what do we do with the energy that comes out of fuels? That part of it that's not lost is heat, of course, because there's always going to be some heat loss. How? The energy that's released by the fuel is used to produce ATP molecules. That's how we store the energy. Okay, so the goal here for the use of a fuel is to make as many ATP molecules as possible. The complete oxidation of glucose does it in such a way that the ATP production is maximized. And that's because a cell will not stop at glycolysis, which only gets a couple ATP per glucose out. There's still a lot of energy left in the only partially spent fuel that glycolysis turns glucose into. And therefore, if you follow that up, follow glycolysis up with the second major part of the overall process, which is cellular respiration, then you can get the rest of the usable energy out and produce a hell of a lot more ATP for that original same glucose molecule that you started with as a fuel. Okay? Maximizing the ATP means completely dismantling the fuel. Glucose is a 6-carbon sugar, right? Getting as much energy as possible means breaking that 6-carbon skeleton into 6 pieces, each with just 1 carbon. A carbon dioxide molecule has just 1 carbon in it. And also picking off all of the hydrogens. That's where those carbon-hydrogen bonds are high-energy bonds. So that's why if you go all the way, start out with glucose and break it all the way down into CO2, which is worthless as far as fuel is concerned, then you've gotten as much energy as possible out of that. And that's where we are here in this chapter, the bottom part of this cycle. All right, let's go to 2. And talk again, because we started this conversation in the lab, about redox. Remember, it's a portmanteau, a word that's a combination of 2 other words, which are what in this case? Reduction and oxidation, right, is what redox is short for. And it's good that they made it into one word, not just easier to say that way. It reminds you of the fact that they always go together. In other words, you don't have only reduction or only oxidation. If you have reduction, then you also have oxidation. If something is reduced, something else has to be oxidized. And that's because electrons don't get destroyed or created, right, in the process. They just get moved around. What is reduction? That's right. The gaining of an electron, just the opposite of oxidation, which is the loss of an electron. Well, this is an example of a redox reaction. You start out with two neutral molecules of metal, of metal and nonmetal, right? Sodium and chlorine. And they both become ions in the process because the sodium atom loses an electron and the chlorine atom gladly takes that electron, right? We've talked about this before. We've used exactly this example before. But now that we've defined redox, you can see that clearly is a redox reaction, right? There is a transfer of an electron, so something is losing it, something is gaining it. The sodium atom, before the transfer, is what becomes oxidized because it's losing the electron. And the chlorine atom is what's becoming reduced because it's gaining the electron. And gaining the electron is why it's now becoming negative, because the electron's carrying negative charge. The sodium, on the other hand, becomes positive because it no longer has that additional negative to counteract one of the protons in sodium. All right, well, that's just a specific example of redox. Whenever you have ionization, that obviously involves transfer of electrons. But you can also have other examples. First, though, in 3, this is just a generic schematization of this, where X and Y don't refer to anything in particular, right? There's no chemical symbol X or Y. It just means whatever the thing is that has the electron first, which is represented as XE minus, because E minus is an electron, is the thing that becomes oxidized. And whatever doesn't have it originally is what becomes reduced, in this case into YE negative. Well, slide 4, though, shows you that it doesn't have to be the case for ionization to occur. In other words, there doesn't have to be a complete transfer of electrons for a chemical reaction to qualify as redox. And in fact, that's usually not the case for the things that we're studying in this chapter. Here we have fuel reacting with oxygen. When a fuel reacts with oxygen, that gets a special name called combustion. This fuel is CH4, which is what? Methane, which is natural gas. It's the simplest hydrocarbon. We've already talked about the fact that hydrocarbons make excellent fuels, right? And the reason they do is because they have carbon-hydrogen bonds. What makes them excellent fuels is the same thing that makes them nonpolar. What makes them nonpolar? Right. More or less equal electronegativities between the atoms in the bonds, involved in the bonds, means that those electrons are equally shared. Only the electrons that are being shared here are the ones that are shown. Those are the blue dots. Each pair is one bond, right? But when there's equal sharing between a carbon and a hydrogen, that means the shared electrons are not particularly close to either atom. That's why they're drawn halfway between the two. And the closer you get an electron to an atomic nucleus, the lower you're going in electron levels, right? Energy levels. Meaning the G goes down the closer you get an electron to the nucleus. Well, here it's not particularly close to either one. So it's at a higher G than it's going to end up being, which should tell you by words I just used right there that combustion reactions are what kind of reactions energetically. If you start with a higher G. Exergonic. When you burn fuels, energy is released, right? You don't have to supply energy. That would be doing exactly the opposite of what you want your fuel to do. You want your fuel to release energy. That's why you're burning it. That's why the car goes down the road, right? So that's exergonic. You start with a higher G, you end up with a lower G. That means the delta G is negative, which is exergonic. But why is this exergonic and why is it a redox? Well, it's not an ionization. There's not a complete transfer of electrons. But notice the starting point. Halfway between the C and H, and also the ones in oxygen, which is the other, has to be oxygen for it to be combustion. Those electrons are being halfway shared between two equally greedy oxygens, right? Neither one wins out, so they're not particularly close to either one either. Well, when the rearrangement occurs, meaning when the reaction takes place, then the fuel is always the thing that becomes oxidized. We use fuels by oxidizing them. And so it is going to turn into carbon dioxide. Not just for methane. Any organic fuel and oxygen will react to produce carbon dioxide and water, plus energy is released as a non-material byproduct. All right? So CO2 and water are the products. Well, CO2, as I said, is completely spent fuel. The reason that it's not useful energetically is because that rearrangement now means that these electrons end up very much closer to the oxygen in the oxygen-carbon bond. Why? Because oxygen has a high electronegativity, carbon a lower. So these electrons end up much closer to an atomic nucleus. They're going down in G. But this isn't a complete transfer of electrons. This is a partial transfer of electrons. Similarly, the electrons in water, which is produced because oxygen gets reduced, it's receiving the electrons in the form of hydrogen, and those electrons also end up very much closer to an oxygen than they were in an oxygen molecule. So this is a redox reaction, but it's a exergonic reaction overall because the electrons are going to a lower energy state. That's lower delta, that's a lower G and therefore a negative delta G. Is that all clear? Yeah, go ahead.
So oxygen being an oxidizing agent, does that mean it takes the electron or it gives it?
Yes, any oxidizing agent is so named because it causes something else to be oxidized. But it does that by becoming reduced itself. Oxygen is becoming reduced. But that can only happen, receiving that electron to become reduced, if something else loses it. That's why it's called the oxidizing agent. It oxidizes the fuel by reducing itself. Does that clear that up? All right, let's go to 5 then. What we are seeing in this slide is a single reaction that is the combustion of glucose. Glucose is C6H12O6. Well, it's one of the isomers that have that formula, right? There are different hexoses, but glucose has that chemical formula. And this is the combustion of glucose. So if you put flame to glucose in the presence of oxygen, in one step, you would turn that into carbon dioxide and water, and a hell of a lot of energy would come out. That's possible, in other words, for this one-step reaction to occur. That's combustion. But cells don't do this. If you think back to when we were talking about thermodynamic systems and looking at those thermoelectric power plants, I said that we're like the open system, but we're even more like the multi-step open system with many little waterfalls instead of just one big one. That's because cells in organisms do not release all of the energy in one step. It would kill the cell because too much would be released at once. And even if the cell survived, it wouldn't give the cell the opportunity to capture usable energy It would just mostly be wasted as heat. So instead, we don't do a one-step combustion of our fuels. We do multiple steps, releasing a little bit of the energy at a time in manageable units. There's a little bit of heat lost in each step, but by releasing it a little bit at a time, the manageable units can be put to use building ATP. That's what we're studying in this chapter, more or less. So this is not what happens in cells. It's not one step. But this has the same beginning and ending point, right? If you think back to slide one when I was explaining the reciprocal relationship between the two processes, this single reaction serves as what we call a summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose. So no, it doesn't happen in one step. It happens in several steps. But what's true about any reaction is that the delta G, as I've said earlier today, depends only on the beginning and the final, only on the reactant and the product. How you get there does not affect delta G. So the overall change in energy, if you do it in many steps, is the same as the overall change in energy, the same delta G, if you do it in one step. This is the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose, even though this is not what happens directly in cells. The intermediate reactions are not shown here, in other words. But going along with what I said in the previous slide, it's always the fuel, which is the glucose in this case, that gets oxidized if you're using the fuel to get energy out of it. We extract energy from fuels by oxidizing those fuels. And to maximize that oxidation, to get as much possible energy out as possible, turning it into completely spent fuel, requires oxygen in our case. And oxygen is the thing that's going to be reduced. It produces water. So we produce what's called metabolic water. That's totally different from water that we drink. We, of course, do drink water, but it's indistinguishable from the water that we also produce as a byproduct of burning our fuels. What were you going to ask?
In this situation, is the glucose the reducing agent?
Well, the reducing agent is always the thing that becomes oxidized. So yes, it's reducing oxygen. So that's why it's the reducing agent. But it's oxidizing, it's becoming oxidized by the oxidizing agent, which is oxygen. All right, let's go on to six. This is not a complete reaction because we don't have complete molecules, right? You can see that this is not a complete molecule on the left. This is just part of glucose, or any fuel. We're studying it from the viewpoint of glucose, but this could be another fuel as well. But think of it as just part of the carbon skeleton. If you look at the overall structural formula of carbon, which you built with the ball and stick models, but you know what I mean by the structural formula on paper, all the C's, H's, and O's, this is just part of it. There would be five other carbons in there as well, right? But there's multiple H's and multiple OH's hooked to those carbons in the carbon skeleton in a monosaccharide like glucose. So this is just part of the overall fuel. Using the fuel completely, though, means breaking up. It means two things, and I've already said these two things, but I'll say them again. It means completely dismantling the carbon skeleton. So instead of having six carbons in one molecule, you have six molecules, each with one carbon. That's dismantling the carbons. And also it means picking off the hydrogens from that fuel. That's where the previous, or two slides ago, came into play with the burning of the methane, right? The reason that they are useful as fuels is because they're carbon-hydrogen bonds, and we get energy out of those carbon-hydrogen bonds by picking the hydrogens off. Well, we see that happening here. This is a reaction in which carbons get picked off of the fuel. Hydrogens get picked off of the fuel. And just like any other chemical reaction occurring in cells, you would expect this to be catalyzed by an enzyme, right? Well, it is. Once again, enzyme is never written on either end of the arrow because it's not a reactant or product. It's written above or below the arrow. In this case, above. And you can tell it's an enzyme. Why?
ASE.
Ends in ASE, exactly. Well, remember that enzymes names, even if they don't end in ASE, they are named usually in one of two ways. Either they're named for the specific substrate that they're able to work on, or they're named for what they do. In this case, this one's named for what it does. It's called dehydrogenase because it's an enzyme that accomplishes dehydrogenation. To dehydrogenate means to pick hydrogens off of something. That's what we do to our fuels. We dehydrogenate them. And that's catalyzed by dehydrogenase enzymes. So what happens when you take these hydrogens off, these two hydrogens, is that that part of the fuel now becomes this carbonyl group, right? The rest of the fuel is there. We're just concerned with this one part of it at the moment. Well, that is going to be another redox reaction, just like picking the hydrogens off of methane was in that first example. So this is a redox reaction. What's new information here is what is also involved in this redox reaction. NAD, which is an acronym, obviously, that stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. So, when you write out its whole name, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, what does that tell you that this thing is? Chemically speaking. It's a dinucleotide, right? Which means you would expect it to be made of two nucleotides. Well, we'll look at a picture of it in a minute and see that that's true. But this nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide is a really important player in this overall process of the complete oxidation of glucose. It's going to be used in many different places along the way, in several of the steps, in other words. And I want you to think of this thing as, well, it is. It's not that I just want you to think of it. It is an energy-carrying molecule. Because electrons represent energy that used to be in the fuel. If they are removed from the fuel, those electrons have energy. And therefore, whatever receives those electrons from the fuel has more energy than it did before. It's carrying some of the energy that was in the fuel originally. Now, in terms of goals, the ultimate goal is to produce ATP because of its versatility, right? ATP is also an energy-carrying molecule. It's a nucleotide as well. It's a single nucleotide, right? This is a combination of two nucleotides hooked together, but it's also an energy-carrying molecule. It's not as versatile as ATP, so it's not the goal. What I mean by that is that the energy that's going to be carried by NAD is going to eventually end up in ATP. But it requires this NAD molecule to pick up the energy from the fuel and eventually deliver it later in the process. So it's an energy-carrying molecule, but I want you to think of it as a little energy taxi, which, just like macroscopic taxis, pick things up and pick up passengers and drop passengers off. That's all they do, right? They don't really have somewhere that is a destination. They have a temporary destination, then they go back and pick up more over and over. That's what taxis do, right? But any given taxi on the street is either one that has a passenger already or one that it's empty. And similarly, these dinucleotides, these NADs, can either be carrying passengers or not. So they exist in two forms. The passengers are hydrogens, or electrons, but electrons that are part of hydrogen. So the passenger is energy in the form of electrons. All right? Now, if a taxi picks up a passenger of electrons, what is happening to that taxi chemically? If it's picking up electrons,
it's being reduced.
It's being reduced, exactly. So get this straight in your head. There are two forms of each individual taxi, each individual NAD. One is the oxidized form, one is the reduced form. The reduced form is the one that is carrying a passenger. So it can't pick up more at the moment. It has to drop them off first. The oxidized form is an empty taxi. Which is the higher energy version?
Oxidized?
No. I just told you earlier that the passengers, these electrons, are energy from the fuel. So when a taxi picks up electrons from the fuel, it becomes higher energy than it was when it was an empty taxi. Okay? So the reduced form is the higher energy version of NAD. The oxidized form, the empty taxi, is the lower energy form. Go ahead.
Is the oxidized form the NADH?
Well, that's where I'm just getting to. Let's look at the actual difference between the formula, the chemical formula for the oxidized and reduced version. Well, before the reaction occurs, the hydrogens are in the fuel. They have the electrons that are represent the energy in the fuel. It's still in the fuel, right? So you should expect this NAD plus to be the empty taxi, right? It's coming along and picking up the electrons in the form of hydrogen from the fuel. So NAD plus is the symbol, chemical symbol, for the oxidized version of nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. These two hydrogens come off of the fuel. Now, two complete hydrogen atoms are what in terms of subatomic particles? If you have two hydrogen atoms, what subatomic particles do you have?
Two protons, two electrons.
Perfect. Yes. Each hydrogen atom is an electron and a proton. So if you have two hydrogen atoms from the fuel, in terms of subatomic particles, you have two electrons and two protons to work with. Is that clear? Okay, now notice that the oxidized form, the empty taxi, is NAD+. So it starts out with a positive charge. You take one of those electrons from these four things that you have, two electrons and two protons. You take one electron and add it to NAD+, that's going to turn it into NAD. Is that clear? It's going to make it neutral, not positive anymore. That means you still have an electron and two protons that haven't been added yet. You with me? Okay, if you take that second electron and one of the protons, together, those two make one hydrogen atom. Okay? If you add those, or that hydrogen atom, that turns it into NADH. And then you have one proton left over, which isn't added to the NAD, but it's still there, and it's still important. That's why the reduced form of NAD is written as NADH plus H plus. A proton also is now in solution that wasn't there before. It was part of the fuel originally. Okay, but you can't just say ignore that proton. It's there. It's just not actually part of NADH. So we write the reduced form as NADH and a proton and H plus. Everyone follow all of that? That is not only the higher energy version of this taxi, NADH, much higher. It's carrying so much energy that it will be enough eventually, later on in the process, to produce multiple ATPs using that energy. So it's much higher level than ATP itself is, which is the goal. But we fill this taxi by stripping off passengers from the fuel itself in the form of hydrogen atoms. And that reduces NAD plus into NADH and H plus. Always keep it straight in your mind that the reduced form is the higher energy form. The oxidized form is empty taxi, lower energy form. Okay.